WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Fresh air. I think of myself as someone who really loves movies, but I often leave the theater restless and dissatisfied, wondering how so much money and such talent produced such a mediocre film. There are some answers in the new book, The Devil's Candy, about the making of Bonfire of the Vanities. This book is by Julie Salomon. She's film critic for The Wall Street Journal. She was given complete access to the production by the film's director, Brian De Palma. Julie Salomon told me she's also often disappointed at the movies, and researching this book helped her explain why.
It's not what you think. You know, somebody sits down, writes a script, and then the director says, gee, that's great, I'm going to go film it. Instead, it's sort of like what used to be the Politburo meeting. You know, this whole committee of people get together and think, we're making this big movie, we're going to spend, you know, 30, then 40, then $50 million. And it becomes sort of this business analysis that starts to move further and further away from the realm of art or entertainment.
Well, the film that you're looking at in your book, The Bonfire of the Vanities, was directed by Brian De Palma. Now, I think of De Palma as being being at his best when he's doing a film that has some real personal interest to him. I mean, I think of him as a very personal kind of filmmaker. But this is like, you know, a big bestseller book that was going to be a big budget movie. And De Palma didn't seem like the obvious choice. Apparently, a lot of other directors were offered this movie and turned it down. Mike Nichols, James Brooks, Norman Jewison. How did De Palma end up with it, and why didn't the other directors want to do it?
Well, I'll start with why the other directors didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do it because they thought it was impossible to do. The Bonfire of the Vanities, the book, Tom Wolfe's book, was a big, sprawling book filled with all kinds of characters, and it was a satire of New York, and it didn't have this, you know, the ingredients a movie needs are characters you can hang on to, follow through a whole story, and in 2 hours or 2.5 hours, wrap the whole thing up. Bonfire of the Vanities is like a whole, it's journalism as much, and I mean that in the very best sense of the word, as much as a novel. It tells you about a whole bunch of slices of life of a city at a particular point in time. To do that as a movie, especially a two-hour movie, seemed impossible to the directors who were approached. It seemed impossible to Brian De Palma. But he was at a point in his career, he told me that the reasons you make movies aren't always the obvious ones. And the point that he was at that time was he had made Casualties of War, which was a Vietnam picture, which he felt was his best film. I thought it was an awfully good film.
Yeah, me too.
It got very good critical reception, but completely bombed at the box office. And De Palma was very low. He felt very depressed after that. And he just wanted to get back to work. And he, you know, the scripts he was getting weren't very good. Most scripts you get aren't very good. And the chance to make Bonfire of the Vanities was very seductive. I mean, that's part of what the title of my book is, The Devil's Candy, and that's part of what that's about, the seduction of Hollywood, to think, well, maybe I can do this thing that nobody else could do. But I think you're right. It was not a personal film for him. It was more like a challenge.
So often when I go see a movie, the people who are the stars of the film just aren't very interesting, and it's people who are on the periphery, the character actors, who are the more interesting actors. And you know that a lot of the casting decisions are probably made on who the producers or the director or whatever thinks is going to be good box office. In Bonfire of the Vanities, the leading role went to Tom Hanks, which seemed like an odd choice to me because he's so boyish, you know, for somebody who's supposed to be the master of the universe. And the way you tell it, it seemed odd to Tom Hanks, too. He felt too young and, well, too boyish for the role. So whose decision was it, and why Tom Hanks?
Why Tom Hanks? Peter Guber. Peter Guber, who is now the head of Columbia Pictures, was at that time a producer at Warner Brothers, and he was riding high because Batman had come out, and it was the biggest movie of all times financially, and so Peter Guber could do no wrong. He read Bonfire of the Vanities, and he told me the instant I read that book, I said, Tom Hanks, Tom Hanks, Tom Hanks. He talks in multiples, you know. And I said, why Tom Hanks? And he said, because Sherman McCoy, who's the bond trader, the bond salesman in Bonfire of the Vanities, is not a very likable character. He's an adulterer. He participates in a hit-and-run accident. He's rich. He works on Wall Street. He's all these things that nobody wants to identify with. And Goober thought by casting somebody like Tom Hanks in that part, the audience would automatically come to the movie with some sympathy for that character, even though he was a no good for nothing. They would think he was good because he was Tom Hanks. And that was why Tom Hanks was cast in that role. I think the bigger problem was casting Bruce Willis to play the dissipated British journalist.
Yeah, this opportunistic journalist. How was Bruce Willis cast in the role?
In that case, Bruce Willis, who was riding high from the success of Die Hard, read the script or heard that Warner Brothers was making Bonfire of the Vanities into a movie, and he expressed interest in being in the movie one way or the other. Well, Tom Hanks was already Sherman McCoy. Bruce Willis couldn't be Maria Ruskin, the mistress. He couldn't be the wife. He couldn't be the Jewish judge, who at that point was still a Jewish judge. So they thought, okay, Bruce Willis can be the British journalist. I mean, it was really just as I know it sounds flip to say it that way, but the decisions were made almost that casually.
This is an example of a movie that went over budget. It's always assumed that when a movie goes out of the budget, it's somehow it's the director's fault. Can you give us some examples of how this movie went over budget in its most typical ways? Like, what's typical that happened in this movie of how budgets just kind of spiral out of control?
Well, this movie going over budget was particularly strange because it doesn't have any special effects. It wasn't shot in Antarctica. What happened in this film was chaos. They filmed a lot because the script kept changing almost from the beginning, partly because they could never get the tone exactly the way they wanted. There was never a schedule imposed on the movie. And a schedule is probably the single most important thing in a movie in terms of the cost, because time is money. One of the things that happened to this movie was 2 weeks before they were going to start shooting, Brian De Palma and the Warner Brothers executives decided that to have racial balance in the movie, because all the blacks portrayed in the movie didn't seem like nice guys, they decided to turn the Jewish judge Kavitsky into a black. So they decided to hire Morgan Freeman. They'd already hired Alan Arkin to play the part for $120,000. Morgan Freeman wanted $650,000. So you pay Morgan Freeman $650,000, Alan Arkin $120,000. You're up to, what, $800,000 for a secondary role. But the big problem was that Morgan Freeman's schedule didn't allow him to go out to L.A. to shoot the scenes on a soundstage courtroom that had been built on the lot at Warner Brothers. So they had to shoot these courtroom scenes in New York. And for the first 4 weeks of production, they didn't know where they were going to shoot the scenes. And the location scouts were running all over New York, New Jersey, Ohio, trying to find a courthouse where they could film these scenes. Finally, after much running around and chaos and money spent, they found a courthouse in Queens that would let them shoot, but only at night, because in the daytime there were real defendants and plaintiffs. So in the end, the cost of hiring Morgan Freeman, because they had to pay double time and triple time to shoot at night, ended up adding about $4.5 or $5 million to the movie's budget. That one casting decision.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Julie Salomon, film critic for The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, The Devil's Candy, an inside look at the making of The Bonfire of the Vanities, which was directed by Brian De Palma. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Julie Salomon, film critic for The Wall Street Journal and author of a new book about the making of The Bonfire of the Vanities, which is a kind of case study in how Hollywood films are made and some of the things that go wrong in the process. Let's talk about something I'm really anxious to hear what you have to say on, and the subject is audience testing. I interview a lot of directors on the show, and I find most directors are very reluctant to talk about this, understandably. I don't think they particularly want to bite the hand that feeds them. but this has been a growing trend for years in Hollywood, that before a movie is released to theaters, it's screened to sample audiences who rate the movie, and then they go back and re-edit the movie based on what the audiences say, and the director loses a lot of control in the process. First, give us a sense of how audience testing works. What happens? How do they find an audience, a sample audience, to screen the movie to?
a lot of the ways they find the audiences nowadays, they use the same methodology that political pollsters use. In fact, the guy who runs a lot of the test screenings for the Hollywood studios now is a man called Joe Farrell, who came out of the Lou Harris organization. He used to do political campaign testing. And now that same kind of testing, which has made our political process such a fun thing, is now also applied to movies. And, you know, they stop people in shopping centers and ask them a few questions, or they'll send out questionnaires in the mail. There are various ways of doing it. And then the audience is invited to come to a free screening of the movie, and they're seeing the movie many times in a primitive state. It may not have gone through the final editing process, which in itself is a little bit difficult for audiences to comprehend. It's not the kind of movie they're used to seeing. So the audience sits there, they watch the movie, and then they're handed out questionnaires, which they fill out. And the questionnaires ask them very basic kind of questions. What did you like? What did you think about this star? What did you think about that star? Which sequences did you like? Then they're asked to rate it excellent, very good, good, poor, and then to give specific comments on what they did or didn't like. And then they're asked to say whether they would recommend it to a friend or not. So ultimately, you're a filmmaker, and this is a nightmare. You've thought about this, you've worked on this film for 2 years or whatever the amount of time is, and then some guy, you know, who's come off the golf course in San Diego is telling the studio how to cut your movie. And the problem with the testing process is these are not professional critics. I mean, even professional critics have a hard time evaluating complex movies. Asking somebody who, you know, this may be the first time they've ever been asked to evaluate something, they may react in a very emotional way, which is partly what the studio wants. But from the filmmaker's point of view, it's a nightmare.
What were some of the responses?
The responses go all over the place, but a lot of, they're usually, I don't like Tom Hanks, think Melanie Griffith is no good, or like Melanie Griffith in her underwear. I mean, they're really goofy, a lot of them. And what they really look for are the numbers, the will recommend, how many excellent and very goods do you get? For a movie to be considered a pretty surefire hit, it has to be in the 90 percentages of excellence and very goods. I think with Bonfire of the Vanities, they were down in the 50 percentages of very goods and excellence, and that is not good.
So how many times was Bonfire screened for test audiences, and how many times was it changed because of audience reaction?
Ultimately, 4 times, and it was changed over and over again. And the main problem they had was over the ending. And they kept changing it and flipping it around and taking endings out and putting new endings in. And by the end, I think De Palma just sort of threw his hands up and said, well, let's do this. Because you just feel kind of beaten down by the end of the process.
Here's another thing that really confuses me about Hollywood the way it is now. You hire a director because you like their vision. You'd think that's why you'd hire them anyways.
Right.
And because they bring a certain personal vision to the movie. And then you screen it for people who have no particular expertise in judging movies. And then you let them decide what the ending of this movie should be. It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. But, you know, there's a point in the book where Steven Spielberg, who is Brian De Palma's closest friend, is talking about De Palma's agony, because this was an agony for him going through this process. But he said, look, if Brian De Palma directs Bonfire of the Vanities, this was a film that is not a Brian De Palma film. This is a film that any one of a number of other directors could have directed. This was not a film that came from his heart and soul. And so he said, at that point, you become, once you buy into the studio system, once you say, no, I'm not making a low-budget film that's my vision, I'm going to make a big-budget studio picture, you're buying into the system, and you can't complain too much about the rigors of that system because you've made your deal with the devil.
Brian De Palma let you in on the set, and you say once he opened up the door, he never flinched. I think very few people would welcome a journalist to watch their working process throughout the making of an entire film. Why do you think he let you do that?
I think that he wanted to have somebody who he respected, and I think he did respect my work, and who he trusted, watch what he did at work. I think that he has felt hurt by the kind of press he's gotten over the years. I think he's encouraged it in some ways by taking people on and being willing to go into head-to-head combat with journalists who have attacked him. But I think he wants to be thought of as a serious filmmaker. And yet, because of the kinds of films he's made, you know, all of the comparisons between him and Hitchcock, he's never been taken seriously in the way that he wanted to. And I think he wanted to somehow demonstrate to the world that, you know, whether a movie that he makes works out, whether it turns out to be considered good or bad, there's a tremendous lot of thought and effort and work that goes into it. And I think he wanted the chance to let somebody in who might report on that. And he was willing to let me look at it warts and all, because I think his feeling is that people have kind of a simplistic idea of why a director does what he does when he or she does it. And he wanted to show all the kinds of pressures that come to bear, financial, artistic, personal, physical. There are all kinds of reasons that decisions are made, and almost none of them are what we think, what we on the outside think that they were when we analyze a movie.
Well, Julie Salomon, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Julie Salomon is film critic for The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is The Devil's Candy, The Bonfire of the Vanities Goes to Hollywood. This is Fresh Air.